right. We are just short of quorum yet, but I am calling the Health and Human Service Reform Committee to order. The first bill that we have up today on the agenda is House File 986. Now, there was a change in how we're going to approach this this morning. House File 986 is only going to be an information hearing, so we're not going to move the bill. There's an amendment that Representative Bennett wanted to present on it that we'll probably be removing quite a bit of what's in there now, but we wanted to have the hearing today and then move the bill next week in its formal order to HHS Finance, but have the hearing today because the testifiers are here, and we want to be able to have the testimony this morning. So with that, Representative Bennett, welcome to the committee. If you could please state your name for the record and tell us about House File 986.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee members, and thank you for hearing this bill. I'm Representative Peggy Bennett from District 27A, and we'd like to present House File 986. And, Mr. Chair, I'm wondering, the amendment is part, the section of the bill that we'll actually be removing, so should I just not offer this amendment?
No, we don't have the bill in front of us for the remove amendment.
All righty. So what we're going to do is I will go through this bill. And I've asked, what happened was we had a section in this bill, the driver's license section, insurance, which I will talk about in just a minute, that we have kind of some last-minute issues with, and I just think it's not quite ready for prime time, and I'm looking forward to hearing from the various groups that have been speaking to me about this. It's something, an important issue, but we need to get it right. So, House File 986, sections 1 and 2 of this bill, excuse me, would add coverage for foster parent property liability insurance. And this is an insurance that foster parents receive from the state. Many youth who are removed from their families and placed into foster care experience abuse, neglect, and, you know, just have a long history of trauma. And some of these youth are pretty wary of trusting adults, and they've learned some survival skills that can lead to acting out behaviors. And some of those behaviors can result in destruction of property. Now, there's many stories of dedicated foster parents who hang in there with these young people, and they stick with them until the child realizes that he or she is safe, and they're able to teach that child new ways of coping with their fear and frustration. But even if the foster parent's homeowner policy would cover this kind of damage to their property, most of them have deductibles of $1,000 or maybe even more. So we ask a lot of foster parents, and I think we don't need to ask them to bear these kinds of costs when they occur. Sections 3 and 4 of this bill, this is the section that we'll actually be removing, kind of setting aside for now, so when I come back next week, this will not be in the bill, but we do want to hear this because it's an important issue and we need to work on it more. And I want to say I do appreciate the groups, some foster parent people and DHS who came to me and kind of explain to me some of the issues with this. So children and youth in foster care need to experience as much of a normalized childhood as they can. And that includes developmentally appropriate social activities, time with their family, friends, and classmates, and so on. Youth in foster care are able to do most of these normal things, but there's one area, which to me, for a teenager, is kind of a rite of passage, and that's getting your driver's license. And this area is an issue because unless the foster parents can afford to add them to their own policy, their auto insurance policy, these young people are not able to get their driver's license or do the normal practicing that a teenager would do in that area. I think that's important. We want these young people to have those experiences that other kids get to have. So we have high expectations for foster parents, and we have high hopes for our youth in foster care. By providing this support to foster parents, we will give youth more opportunity to experience an important skill and rite of passage toward their adulthood. So I have a couple of testifiers here, and I know there's some people who are going to testify with the concerns on that driver's license portion. So I think I will start by introducing George Hendrickson, who is director of Kindred Family Focus and is also a former foster parent.
All right, Mr. Hendrickson, welcome to the committee. If you could please state your name for the record and present your testimony.
Good morning. My name is George Hendrickson, and I want to thank you for the opportunity to share both my experience as a foster parent and as a human services administrator for the last 38 years. I've been aware of the prudent parenting movement for since its inception, and I can say that I fully support what the intents are of that. I have three biological children, and during their adolescent years, my wife and I provided foster care to two adolescent boys that lived with my three children. We worked diligently to create similar life experiences for all five youth in our home. Our biological children had the use of our car, got themselves to school, work, friend outing, shopping, and otherwise just time to themselves if they felt like doing something. Eventually, one of our foster youth did, the other did not. And when we asked the county whether the foster youth should be allowed to drive most often, county attorney said no due to the liability risk that the county would experience. We agreed with both boys that we'd consider allowing them to drive if they maintained at least a C average in school, had no contact with law enforcement, held their jobs, and paid their own insurance. One of the boys accomplished these expectations and honestly it managed his life as well as our own three children. We helped him purchase a small truck, his life expanded, and he managed it well. He graduated high school, is married, has children, and is gainfully employed. Thankfully, there was never an accident or driving tickets on his part, so our life was simple with him. We understood our auto insurance policy was at risk because he lived in our home, and an expense to his policy beyond his insurance limits might fall to our insurance, and so it was a risk that we were willing to take in his case. The other young man wasn't as successful. His life experiences were different, and he wasn't able to really maintain the same level that we expected someone to have if they were going to get behind the wheel of a car. We came home one afternoon, and my wife and I both looked at each other, and something was different because one of the cars was gone out of the driveway. We had no idea where it had gone, so we waited it out. And later that afternoon, this young man showed up driving the car, and we asked him what he was doing because he didn't have a driver's license. He didn't have permission to drive, and his comment was he just wanted to know what it felt like. And it's hard to blame him because all of his friends were driving, similarly to the other foster youth and our own children. So it was a learning experience for us because his desire to have a normalized adolescence was driving his decisions. Foster parents are asked to care for someone else's son or daughter and are expected to parent them as they would their own children in whatever time that we have with them. We can't fix everything in short order, but we can provide life experiences that help prepare them for independence. We all know that ensuring an adolescent is expensive. Providing support to both the foster youth and the foster parent is essential to normalcy, and I fully support the language in this bill.
All right, questions for Mr. Hendrickson? Seeing none, the committee thanks you for your testimony this morning, Mr. Hendrickson. Yep. Representative Bennett.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee. We have another testifier, and it's George Van Leer from... Gregory. Oh, I should read that correctly. It's too early in the morning. Gregory Van Leer, he's a foster parent with St. David's Center.
All right, Mr. Van Leer, welcome to the committee. If you could please state your name for the record and present your testimony.
Hey, my name is Gregory R. Van Leer, Sr., and thank you for allowing me to come forward and testify. I've done foster care for about 15 years, did about 10 years in Washington County. I'm currently with St. David Foundation. I work specifically with kids who have a lot of behavior problems, and so the interest in this bill and your committee definitely has a personal appeal for myself. We take kids in who have a lot of behavior problems. A lot of times they are somewhat a danger sometimes to themselves, but also to property. Takes a while to kind of get these kids kind of turned around and straightened out. So for us to have that extra help in that area really makes gives us a lot of support. I've had about 60 kids that go through my house in foster care at the time I've been doing it. A lot of more young kids, but I had several who were, and actually my first foster child was with me all the way through high school. At the time, they didn't have the system set up to where she could stay in it, and she went to college, but we kept her in our home and allowed her to stay with us as she transitioned on through. We felt that was you know, that's what we needed to do. Currently, we have a young lady in our home who is just turned 17. She's already indicated she wants to go on to college, but she wants to stay with us and go through the whole program. She currently does not have a driver's license. We talked about it this summer. She said, well, I just assume kind of wait till next year, which is down this year, this summer, when she can take her test, because I can get a ride with my friends, whatever, but I can see that itching kind of, she's ready to go out there and do something. Our concern initially was what it was going to cost our driver's insurance, how much it's going to take to hit for us. I have a lot more trust for her, but I think one of the issues is when kids come into the system and you may get them close to that 15 to 16-year-old age, you don't really know who they are or what they're about. And just as Caesar was speaking about the difference between the two kids, you have one, which one of my oldest son was a perfect child. My second one wasn't. I wouldn't trust him with my car right now. And so you don't know this about the kids coming in who, you know, what they may be about, their personnel and so forth or whatever. So to have that kind of help or that kind of assistance that would take that burden off of the foster parent, I think that would really give us a really sound peace of mind in that area, as well as the whole financial hit. Well, last year we discussed quite a bit about some of the rates being cut. So if rates going to be cut, then we need to help with the insurance so that we can cover that part and not necessarily have to be so overly concerned about that part, and that it's not a part of our own financial picture, but it's something that will be independent of what we do.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Van Leer, for your testimony this morning. Are there questions for Mr. Van Leer? Seeing none, the committee thanks you for your testimony this morning. Representative Bennett, do you have any other testifiers for this bill?
I think there may be some people here who'd like to speak.
All right, they can start making their way down. All right, welcome to the committee. If you could please state your name for the record and present your testimony.
Thank you. My name is Hank Malatsky, and I'm the executive director of a newly founded organization called Foster Alumni of Minnesota. We just founded in January, and we have over 50 members right now. I'm an alumni of the foster care system, and I aged out at 18. When I was 15, the first thing that my new foster parents, I just moved in with them, said is, you are going to take your driver's permit, and you will get a driver's license. You will have a job. You will pay for your insurance. You will buy your own car. And these are all life lessons that helped me learn responsibility, learn how to take care of myself, gave me autonomy, gave me independence. When I did go off to college, I unfortunately was one of those 17-year-olds who was done with his car and crashed it. So when I went off to college, I didn't have a car, but I had my license, and that still gave me freedom and autonomy to come and go over the breaks and such. And my sophomore year of college, I got my second car, and same thing, that helped me have a full-time job while I went to school and gave me, again, those life lessons, autonomy. And I know at the time when I was in care, I was the only foster youth in the different groups I was a part of that had their license and had access to a car. So I think that normalcy component is very important. And I can tell you every one of the members of the foster alumni group has messaged me and asked me to make sure that this happens. Most of them were not able to get a license. Most of them were not able to get a car. And many of them struggled as they aged 18 and moved on into adulthood.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Morotsky, for your testimony this morning. Are there any questions for him? Looks like it not. All right. Welcome to the committee. If you could please state your name for the record and give us your testimony.
Good morning. I am Taylor Vandenberg, and thank you, Chair Schumacher and committee, for allowing me to speak today. My mother is a foster care provider in Anoka County. I'm a resident of Oak Grove, Minnesota. And she's been a foster care provider for 18 years, and I have subbed for her as a provider many times. Over the years, we would say that probably a third of the placements my family has had have been ages teenager to age 21. And we want to thank you for bringing this bill forward. However, we do have concerns with the bill, HF986, and the provision to reimburse foster homes for the automobile insurance for the foster children in care. The Insurance Federation of Minnesota told us yesterday that a family today in Minnesota with a foster child with a driver's license would be covered under the family auto policy. This is done under the definition of insured. If the family cannot buy coverage on the market, they have the auto insurance plan, which is a state-created facility that guarantees coverage, a policy to the family. Therefore, this bill is not needed. The families are already provided under current insurance guidelines. Our main concern is diverting funds. So families are desperately in need of funds in order to raise and care for their foster children. Currently, the basic rate starts at $18.58. That's due to go up to $21.67. But that's not a very large increase. And so we would rather see these additional funds be channeled over to that basic rate, and then families could choose to pay for the insurance out of their basic rate that they would be given for the care of the child. We don't have a problem with foster care children having their license. It's a matter of where those funds are going and what they're being used for. Currently, there is a foster parent crisis all over the state. My mom had calls for 5 different placements this week already. Adding money to the basic rate will increase the number of foster care providers in the state that are able to take care of our vulnerable children. We want to work with you moving forward to make this bill fit to the best possible needs of foster care providers and foster children in the state. Thank you.
All right. Thank you, Ms. Vandenberg, for your testimony this morning. Are there questions for Ms. Vandenberg? Seeing none, the committee thanks you for your testimony this morning. Is there anyone else who wishes to testify on House File 986? And again, members, we are not moving the bill today, but we wanted to get the testimony out. There are some changes that Representative Bennett and the department would like to make, and we will bring this bill up next week, but want to have the testimony today to get that done. Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I just wonder if Representative Bennett would respond to what the last testifier said, because, I mean, I have to say that hearing the news secondhand from the Insurance Federation doesn't give me complete comfort that that's the actual state of the law. So I wonder if she could respond.
Representative Bennett.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative Liebling. Very good question. I have not heard about that coverage to this point. When I spoke to the Department of Health and Human Services yesterday, they didn't bring that up. They actually like the idea of working with this so that young people can get insured without, devastating their foster family. So I guess that's something we'll have to look into, and that's why right now this section is just not ready for prime time. We need to do a little more digging with it. I know the Department of Health and Human Services has, different issues they brought up. For example, when young people start with one foster parent, maybe they get insurance with that parent, and suddenly they're moved to a different family, then there's issues of taking them off that insurance, getting them on another. There's a lot of things we need to look at, as well as the funding mechanism. So very good question, and that's something that I will research as we look into this part more.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Any other questions? Representative Moran.
Mr. Chair, can you explain the intent of this bill today, just the path that...
Yes, Representative Moran, for today it's information only. We wanted to get the testimony through because people are already making their way through here. Representative Bennett has promised me that there will be an amendment coming forward to make some changes. We'll hear that amendment next week. We just won't have any additional testimony for it at that time.
I'll wait for my comment until the end.
All right. Any other questions for Representative Bennett? All right. Thank you, Representative Bennett, for that. I will...
Mr. Chair, excuse me. May I make one more comment about this bill before we...
Representative Bennett.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Representative Moran, appreciate your concern with this bill, too. And my intent here, when it comes back to committee, would be to bring back just the portion with the property insurance issue. We're going to hold off on the driver's license part until I can work with these groups and get it right. So that will not be coming back next week, but will be a future bill at some point. And Mr. Chair and Kirby, thank you so much. And I just want to take this time to thank our foster parents. Isn't it fun to hear the stories of how these parents actually make a real experience for these young people, including, you know, telling them, you know, you've got to get good grades or get your grades at least a C like they would their regular children. So I just want to thank foster parents for the wonderful job that they do and would love to continue to work with them on this issue.
All right. Thank you, Representative Bennett. With that, I will officially call the meeting to order. We do have a quorum, and Representative McDonald moves the minutes from Tuesday, February 21st. Are there any additions, corrections, or changes to be made to the minutes? Seeing none. All those in favor of adoption of the minutes from Tuesday, February 21st, 2017, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, same sign. The minutes are adopted from Tuesday, February 21st, 2017. The first bill we will be moving today, members, is House File 987, Representative Bennett. I will move that House File 987 be referred to the Committee on Health and Human Service Finance. And Representative Bennett, you have an A1 amendment to this.
I do, Mr. Chair, and thank you for hearing this bill, Mr. Chair and Committee. The A1 amendment basically is a little bit of a language and technical amendment to add things like commas, and we're inserting a must instead of shall. So I can explain the bill more, but if we could just move this amendment to get the bill in the...
Are there any questions for the A1 amendment? Seeing none, all those in favor of the A1 amendment signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign. The A1 amendment is adopted. Representative Bennett, to your bill in the form you wish to present it.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. House File 987 is, again, helping something that I believe will really help our young people who are going through the foster care system. In 2008, President George W. Bush signed into law the Fostering Connections for Adoption and Success Act. And among other things, this provided federal funding for youth ages 18 to 21 for extended foster care, independent living settings, and services. Minnesota has implemented many of the provisions of this act, but it does limit the opportunity for youth who age out of care to opt back into those youth who are wards of the state. So it only applies to those foster care youth who are wards of the state. And those obviously are whose parents' rights have been terminated. This bill extends the option to return for support to all youth who age out without a permanent or reliable family if they meet the federal eligibility requirements. We have removed these young people from their families and taken on the responsibility to parent them. As we all know, good parenting doesn't stop at age 18. So I'm going to pass this on here to my testifiers who can explain a little bit more. We have Mary Reagan and Joan Riebel.
All right, welcome to the committee. If you could please state your name for the record and present your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Mary Reagan. I'm the Executive Director of Aspire Minnesota, formerly known as the Minnesota Council of Child Caring Agencies. We're a provider association of a membership association of providers of treatment and intervention services for children and adolescents in the child welfare, mental health, and juvenile justice system. We are very pleased that Representative Bennett has brought this bill forward today. As she mentioned, the option for federal support, federal funding support through Title IV-E, has been available since President Bush signed this act into law in 2008. In 2010, Minnesota did extend this to youth who aged out as wards, but made it optional for youth who age out who are not wards. And frankly, any child who's still in foster care at 18 is there because they do not have a viable family, because they do not have a viable place to return to, because it is the expectation that the social service system will reunify young people with their families. We're actually not talking about very many young people, and the fiscal note is still being worked on, but the estimates are that this is going to be less than 50 young people that we're talking about. But these are 50 very important lives that we have invested in, that we have changed by removing them from their families, and I'm not aware of too many 18-year-olds who are able to be completely independent at 18, who don't call back home, who don't come back home, who don't need the support on an ongoing basis to make that transition to a healthy adulthood. So this really extends that opportunity for those young people to say, yeah, I know I wanted to be out on my own, but guess what? It didn't work out so well, or I lost my apartment, or I lost my roommate, or I lost my job. And this is the safety net we need for these very few but very important young people. Chicago has an institute called Chapin Hall, and they did an analysis a number of years ago about the impact of allowing young people to remain in care till 21. And it was called the Midwest Study, and they looked at Iowa, Wisconsin, and Illinois. And Illinois at the time was the only state that allowed young people and encouraged them to stay beyond the age of 18. They found significant differences in long-term outcomes for those youth who are able to retain that support until they're just a little bit older and a little more stable. California has done a study that shows for every dollar invested in young people in foster care between the ages of 18 and 21, there's a return of $2.40. So it's the right thing to do on all levels, and we hope you will support this.
Thank you, Ms. Regan, for your testimony this morning. Welcome to the committee. If you could please state your name for the record and present your testimony.
Good morning. My name is Joan Riedel. I'm the executive director of Family Alternatives, which is a private nonprofit foster care agency in Minneapolis. We have fostered over 11,000 children in our 39-year history. As you may imagine, we have many stories of youngsters we have known and loved over the years. But today, one in particular tugs at my heart. The story is about Michael, who is now 23 years old, an African-American man who currently resides in St. Cloud Prison for theft and assault. Let me tell you his story. Michael was born in Hawaii, the oldest of three children. When he was 5 years old, his parents, mother and father, were arrested for drug possession. The children were all placed in foster care. His dad was released shortly thereafter and immediately moved to Florida to live with his parents. His mother was sentenced to a lengthy prison term. The children remained in foster care in Hawaii. The court terminated their parental rights, making them eligible for adoption. That's when Minnesota became involved. A family in Greater Minnesota made a decision to adopt the three children, and they moved here when Michael was 8. Moving from Hawaii to Greater Minnesota was a big adjustment for Michael. He and his sisters were the only kids of color in their school and in their social environment. Because of the distance, they had had no interaction with the family prior to moving here. Michael began acting out almost from the day he became an adopted child. When Michael was 11, the adoptive parents decided that he needed more intensive help, and they had him admitted to a residential treatment center for mental health treatment. Michael was in the center for 18 months and was released from there into one of our foster homes in Minneapolis when he was 13. While in our care, Michael did well. He excelled in school, he was active in theater, he wrote poetry and performed spoken word at a local coffee shop. He was very active in our programming and became a youth leader. I remember so clearly when he volunteered to speak at a state conference of youth workers about his experience in foster care. He was confident and articulate, and he was proud of himself. Meanwhile, his adoptive parents had no contact with him, and more importantly, they would not allow him to contact his sisters. But they did not terminate parental rights. So legally, he still had parents. When we would go with Michael to his regularly scheduled court hearings 90 minutes away, his adoptive parents would be present, but they had no interaction with him. Michael also made no attempt to talk with them. They would acknowledge that he had no emotional ties to them. One day when Michael was about 17, he walked into my office. He had tears falling down his face. He told me he had just talked to his birth mother for the first time since he was 5. She was out of prison living in Hawaii, but she told him she couldn't take care of him as she had a very menial job, and she encouraged him to stay here and finish high school. Shortly after that, he received word that his mother had died from an overdose. When Michael graduated from high school in Minneapolis, he was 18. He made a decision to go to Florida to be with his father. We encouraged him to have his dad come here to show that he was interested, but that didn't pan out. And in June, Michael left on a bus trip for Florida. There he found his father, a practicing alcoholic without a job and renting a room from a friend. He then went on to his grandparents' home and stayed for a few weeks, but they told him they couldn't take care of him because they had few resources. In July, Michael contacted us and said he wanted to come back to Minnesota, but he didn't have money to pay for his bus ticket. We sent him the money, and he came back to Minnesota. But because he was not a ward of the state, and because he had left foster care voluntarily, he was no longer eligible for any foster care assistance. He was on his own. The foster home he had lived in now had other placements, and he couldn't live there on a regular basis. He couch hopped for a while, but by fall he was homeless. He's now in prison for theft and assault. He stole several computers and hit someone as he did. As I said in my opening, Michael's story tugs at my heart. Imagine if he had been able to return to foster care. Imagine if he had adults he could rely on, like most kids have. If he had been eligible for extended foster care and post-high school assistance, I believe he would have become a successful citizen. He may still, but our dollars are going to a prison instead of to post-secondary education and housing. I think that's a shame.
All right. Thank you, Ms. Riebel, for your testimony this morning. That was a very interesting perspective that you presented for us. Are there any questions for Ms. Regan or Ms. Riebel? Representative Liebling.
Thank you. Not so much a question, but just thank you for being here and bringing us that story. You know, any of us who've had kids and had seen them grow up, you know, we know that at 18, they're not really fully adults. It's just, they just aren't. You know, I often, when my own kids, and they're older than that now, that when they need something, even if it's just emotional support, I often think about the kids that don't have that. I think it's a very real thing. So thank you very much for bringing that. Thank you, Representative Bennett, for bringing the bill.
Representative McDonald.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just curious, a question for Ms. Reagan. Approximately how many children would this help that are age 18 to 21? Did you say that earlier, and if so, I missed it.
Well, we're still waiting.
Ms. Reagan.
Mr. Chair, Representative McDonald, we're still waiting for that final data from the Department of Human Services, but the estimates are it's probably going to be less than 50 that will need this.
Representative McDonald.
Thank you, and that's 50 per year. And that would fluctuate, I would presume.
Again, it's an estimate, but yes, that's what I'm thinking they're telling us.
And then, Mr. Chair, a question for the second testifier.
Representative McDonald.
In your opinion, was it wise for the adoption agency to have the young man, the young boy, adopted in Minnesota and not by the parents in Hawaii?
Ms. Riebel.
It reminds me of a story of an incident that I experienced when I was in Japan once. They said, why are people adopting children from overseas when we have so many children in the United States that need adoption? And I can't really answer that. I don't know for sure what the motivation is. I know that people apply to be adoptive parents, and there's a roster of kids that are available throughout the United States, and they can, you know, they can go wherever. It's a philosophical question, I guess.
Representative McDonald.
No, just I'm familiar. My mom was adopted, so it's a pretty emotional story for those who haven't.
We have many kids. We have many kids in foster care who are from adoptive families. Currently at Family Alternatives, roughly 30% of our kids are failed adoptions. And some of those kids are from other parts of the world, and some of them are kids that were born in Minnesota. Doesn't seem to matter too much, I guess, where they come from, although cultural differences certainly affect the success of an adoptive family, I think.
Representative Moran.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I want to thank Representative Bennett for bringing this bill forward. I think it's a good bill. You know, there's lots of statistics that tell us that often kids who are in foster home or in failed adoptions, that they end up homeless, addictive, and in prison, you know, suffering from trauma and toxic stress and being isolated. And so creating an opportunity for these kids who are in the system, and you know, at 18, you know, many of our own kids are not, you know, yet prepared for the world, and yet they are put out into the world to fend for themselves. So creating a space for them to have an opportunity to go into a 21 with some type of support, I think it's the right thing to do, and also it's a needed thing that needs to happen within our system. You know, we have more kids coming to our system now, you know, and yeah, there is a great need for foster parents. And, you know, and I was a speaker at the annual foster parent recognition event, so I value foster parent, but we also know the need to really try ways to connect kids back with their family, if at all possible, and really look at a strength-based model, which is providing families with the resources that they need so that they can be self-sufficient and able to take care of the needs that or whatever those parents are going through. So, again, I don't have a question, but I just wanted to say to Representative Bennett, you know, it's a good bill, and I hope we are able to find a way to support these kids and young adults.
Representative Moran. Representative Tice.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Is it possible to call back one of the previous testifiers, Mr. Van Leer?
If from the last Mr. Bill? Van Leer would make his way forward again, if he's still here. Representative Tice.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Van Leer, I think you mentioned that somebody that you have now is interested in staying till longer than 18.
Yes, ma'am.
Why, I guess, what is the thought process? What are your thoughts on that? I mean, this bill is before us saying we should have them in foster care till 21, and I'm a big fan of it, but I think we need to hear what you think, I mean, why you think this is a huge advantage.
Well, Mr. Van Weer, if you could introduce yourself again for this bill and answer Representative Tice's question.
Okay. Director Yard Van Leer Sr. Thank you, Mr. I've had two kids that I've had to help beyond their stay time. One came back, actually, at about 20, went back to his house. It was still turmoil with him and his mom. I ended up having to take him back in my house for about 9 or 10 months for him to get himself together, which he's doing fine now. But if there was no safety net for him at that point, which really shouldn't have left in the first place, then who knows what would have happened. My young lady I have right now, her mom has a lot of different problems going on mentally. She's not going back with her. When she gets to be 18, where is she going? So I had several kids that were in this kind of situation, and so it's not a lot of kids this happens with. But for those who are there when they turn 18, this is a great way to help them and to bridge that divide. Now, this one I got right now, she was a mess when she came. She's doing much better now, and she really needs that support when she turns that 18 and graduates. She has a plan in place, but she still needs somebody to assist her. She still needs someone to help her. She still needs really to be in a home that's, you know, caring and nurturing and helping her get through this transition period. And so I think it's vital that we have this in place for those kids. And as the person was saying, we really don't have that many. I would assume there would have been a lot more, simply because I've had about 3 or 4 of them that had gotten to that place. So I would hope that the committee would obviously consider it. I think it would be a very valuable addition to the package that we have. And that transition period is so vital, and our kids really need it. And in an environment today that's so toxic with so many different things going on, we really need someone actually to continue to steer their lives, or at least give them some good information on how to make the right choices at that time. And so if they have nowhere to go, But what it comes down to is really they have nobody to trust. It makes it difficult for them to enter that time between that 18 and 20 and try to navigate life as it is. And so I would just hope that the committee would think about that and would be considerate in moving that bill forward so that we can get this protection in place.
All right, Representative Tice.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think we just really need to hear from somebody who would be directly involved with this to say this is absolutely vital. And you did. And I thought you would.
Okay.
And I guess I love this because when you have kids who really, family for them is many different things, but when they find a family that is their support, I think it's ridiculous that we don't continue that because then we hear the stories of Michael. And now I'm sitting here thinking, now what happens to Michael when he finally leaves? Who's going to be there for him then?
Yeah.
So I appreciate your comments and I appreciate your time coming here. And I just, you said exactly what I was hoping you would, so thank you.
Well, thank you. Can I say one more thing, Mr. Chairman?
Mr. Van Leer.
Okay. Because my young lady was supposed to come this morning and testify also, her point that she wanted to get across, I believe, was that being accepted in the family and being treated just like the rest of the kids is so vital, and she really feels that. And so the homes that can really give that kind of encouragement and nurturing and then do it all the way through, that's going to really give these kids a chance to be successful in life. And that's what we really want. We want them to be successful without having to be dependent on the government services, you know, through that period of time. Thank you.
All right, Mr. Van Leer, thank you for your testimony on this bill as well. Ms. Westland, without further testimony, if you can make your way down and introduce yourself for the record and present your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, ladies and gentlemen of the committee. My name is Rochelle Westland, and I'm the Health and Human Services Policy Analyst for the Association of Minnesota Counties. Thank you for the opportunity to be here to speak today on this bill. I want to start by saying that counties appreciate the spirit of this bill. We agree that these children need services from 18 to 21, and we want to be supportive of that. Counties' concerns, however, lie in the funding. And while we recognize that there is Title 40 funding that comes down from the federal government, there is a space where counties are responsible for the additional cost for care for these children. Even with 50 children, that is an estimated between $200,000 and $500,000 annually for the state of Minnesota for counties to invest in these services. And again, counties recognize that we are partners in providing services for children that are in the child protection system. Counties invest a large amount of money into the child protection system. And while we appreciate the additional $52 million that was invested in 2015 into child protection and foster care, we've seen numbers increase significantly. An additional $30 to $40 million have been taken on by counties during that time statewide. This is just in Health and Human Services. This does not include additional costs to court systems or in additional costs in areas of public safety. So while this bill may seem like a small amount in that large pool of child protection and foster care funding, we think that there really does need to have a robust conversation about what it really means to meet the needs of this system, including this one, which, like I said, we do agree is very important to continue those services for children from, or young adults from 18 to 21. So we ask that as you're looking at this bill and these very valuable services, that you consider having a state investment rather than solely a county investment for paying for these additional services.
Questions for Ms. Westland? Seeing none, the committee thank you for your testimony this morning. Is there anyone else who wishes to testify on House File 987? Seeing none, any final questions for the bill author? Seeing none, final word, Representative Bennett.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee, for hearing this bill. And just want to reiterate that what we've heard here is that in our families, children who are I guess blessed enough not to have to go into the foster care system, they don't get a hard cutoff at age 18. They typically have parents that are there for them as they transition into adulthood and kind of away from the home. And I also believe that our children who are in this situation where they have to be removed from their families are blessed to have foster parents that are willing to support them and help them as they grow and mature. And we just understand that they also should not have that hard cutoff. There are some of them that need that transition. So thank you for being willing to hear this bill. And I'll just close by saying...
Actually, Representative Bennett, Representative Liebling has a question.
Thank you. I'm sorry to interrupt you, Representative Bennett, but I'm looking at the bill and I'm thinking about the testimony of the Ms. Westland from the counties. And I just wanted to ask you, Mr. Chair, so I noticed there is no fiscal piece to this bill. As I'm looking at it, it looks like it's just a policy bill. And obviously it will...
Going to the Finance Committee.
Okay, that was going to be my question. Just so it will have a fiscal note and we'll be able to see and deal with the fiscal impact.
Right.
Great.
Yes.
Thank you very much. I'm sorry, Representative Bennett.
No. Representative Bennett.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative Liebling. And that's the fiscal note is still out there waiting, so hopefully we can get that back soon. So I just want to close by saying that as a former teacher of 33 years, children are very important to me, very precious. I believe that they are a treasure both for now and for our future. And I again want to thank foster families for playing that role to help these young people who are living very difficult experiences to be able to experience as normal a childhood as they can. So thank you again.
All right. Thank you, Representative Bennett. With that, I renew my motion that House File 987, as amended, be referred to the Health and Human Service Finance Committee. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, same sign. The motion prevails on House File 987, as amended, is referred to the Committee on Health and Human Service Finance. Thank you, Representative Bennett. Next, we have House File 1412, Representative Pearson. As Representative Pearson makes his way to the table, I will move that House File 1412 be referred to the Committee on Health and Human Service Finance. Representative Pearson, when you are ready, please present your bill.
Thank you, Chair Schumacher. I can't move this bill. Did you already move it?
Already done.
Thank you very much. I'm here today with House File 1412. I've got this great prepared background for everyone, but that's not as compelling, I tend to think. So I'll just share a little bit of my story. I think for new members, they may not be aware that I adopted a son from the Democratic Republic of Congo last year. He was a visitor to the floor during 1 week and got to meet everybody on Dad's job. When he didn't speak English, it was kind of hard to explain to him where I was Monday through Thursday or even longer, so we just immersed him in it for a little while. So anyhow, I'm here with House File 1412, which is really personal for me, and having gone through this process of adoption myself, I just know how important first of all this is for the kids, number one, and number two, having that support there for the families is just so vital for anyone even thinking about doing this. On Monday I had our first interview with our social worker, because we have to wait a year between major life events before we can start adoption, and this time we're looking at the Minnesota Waiting Kids program. And so we've gone through a lot of the training already, and there are a lot of resources that are there, and without that knowledge, without that training, you begin to understand why so many children don't work out when they're first adopted, because it is hard. And when people go into this not knowing what they're getting into, when people go into this not knowing where to find help or support, bad things happen to kids, and bad things happen to families. And so this bill really pushes hard to make sure that those resources are available. In the state of Minnesota in 2015, there were 662 children that were adopted through foster care in Minnesota. And again, this is what we're really trying to accomplish. And again, knowing that those resources and support systems are there and available, and how important they've been for my family. As I'm sitting here, my wife is texting me during the other, and the teacher had to call today for a conference just to say how well my son is doing. And it really is remarkable considering a year ago he didn't speak English. A year ago he didn't know the kids he was going to school with. They elected him as his class representative. It really is just amazing to see these children thriving in their new homes. And there are happy stories and there are sad stories. And we heard from earlier testimony some of the latter. And I'm hoping we can continue to tell happy stories and help these kids and families with this type of a bill. So with that, I'll introduce my testimony. Today will come from, we'll start with Mary Boo, who's the executive director with the North American Council for Unadoptable Children.
All right, Ms. Boo, welcome to the committee. If you could please state your name for the record and begin your testimony.
Thank you. My name is Mary Boo, and I thank you, Representative Pearson, and thank you, Chairman. I also want to thank you, Representative Schumacher and Representative Halverson and Zerwas, for already supporting this bill. And we thank all of you for listening to us here today. I'm with the North American Council on Adoptable Children, which is located here in St. Paul. And we at NACAC provide services in the U.S. and Canada to ensure that children in foster care have permanent families and that adoptive families have the support they need to help children who've been abused and neglected to thrive. In Minnesota, we provide parent-to-parent support to about 1,400 adoptive families across the state through the Adoption Support Network. And we've been providing that parent-to-parent support here in Minnesota since 1999, and we're grateful to the Department of Human Services for making that possible. And as Representative Pearson said, we're here today to seek support for a program to support adoptive, foster, and kinship families, families who are helping abused and neglected children to heal. And although the state does provide some support to adoptive families, including our own program, the gaps are significant, especially in greater Minnesota. Support for foster families varies by county or agency, and over time these support services have ebbed and flowed, which makes it difficult for families doing sometimes heroic work to know whether they'll have the support they need to meet their children's needs. We need comprehensive, steady support services to meet the needs of hurt children, services that reduce the immense cost of group care and failed placements, some of which we've heard about today. We know that states like Alabama, Tennessee, Georgia, Missouri, Illinois are already embracing these comprehensive support services for adoptive and guardianship families. We believe it's time for Minnesota to provide smarter, more sensitive level of care for the most vulnerable children. And so why do we need these services? And some of this we've heard about before, and I don't want to. We know children in foster care have experienced significant trauma, often repeated abuse, long-term neglect. At a minimum, they've lost their first families. And many of them have been exposed to drugs and alcohol in utero, which can cause permanent brain damage. And then instability in foster care can make these situations worse, as children wonder, where am I going to live? Who can I trust? Who's going to take care of me? These traumas have consequences that are lifelong. They have increased physical, mental, and behavioral difficulties, including PTSD, anxiety, depression, anger, mental illnesses. Many have learning disabilities or difficulties in school. And these difficulties don't go away with permanent placement with kin or with adoption. Although these are critically important, they don't erase children's pasts. All of this makes being an adoptive, foster, or kinship care provider different and difficult. Although it's joyous, too, and Julie will talk a little bit more about both those highs and lows. So what do good support services look like? We're advocating for a Minnesota program that offers services such as the following. Peer support for parents and youth, including in-person support groups, online support groups, mentoring programs, buddy programs. Respite care is really important. It's one of the top needs that parents have when they're raising children who can be challenging. They need a break so they can regroup and keep going. We need navigator services where experienced parents or other professionals can help parents find the services they need to meet their children's needs. One of the things we'd love to see are dedicated mental health services for the whole family rather than just the particular person who may have access to an insurance policy. And there are a number of evidence-based programs that are showing really good work with foster care and adoptive families where they're treating the whole family, not just an individual child. It'd be great to have a crisis hotline for parents to call with staff who can triage their needs and they can meet those needs when they have them anytime. And we know ongoing training on disabilities, trauma, fetal alcohol spectrum disorder, parenting strategies are really important. Again, one of the top things we hear about, the need for support with schools. Parents may often need help understanding how to get an IEP or what to do with it. In foster care, kids may need help transferring credits when they've moved to a new school. It's a huge issue of loss of credits. Another thing is teaching school personnel about the effects of trauma. And I don't want to forget that we need services that include activities for children and youth, which enables them to build relationships and interact with their peers. What we've seen is that children who experience trauma often have difficulty with relationships, and these activities give them a safe space to do these things. And we run a support group for teens here in the Twin Cities, and there was a mom called us because the group's party for her daughter was the first time she'd ever had friends to celebrate a birthday with in her whole life. And we know these services are going to make a difference, but studies have shown that support pays off by helping parents be more effective at raising children who've experienced trauma. We know they can prevent unplanned placement moves in foster care and can keep adopted and kinship families together, preventing foster care reentry or placement in higher level of care. They also help recruit foster and adoptive families, which is a tremendous need right now. Families are more willing to come forward if they know there's going to be support to help them down the road. And the NEA Casey Foundation did a study that showed 40% of foster parents leave because of lack of support. We need to keep those good foster parents with us, working with the kids. Services also reduce parental stress and isolation. They help parents know they're not alone and know they can do it because they see other parents succeeding even when their challenges are significant. And we know that services can also reduce children's problem behaviors, helping them learn to trust and attach to their caregivers. Every child needs and deserves a family. It's what we all want for our kids and what we want for our families. They need a family equipped to meet their needs. It's supporting children is the right thing to do, but it's also an effective use of government funds. Adoptions from foster care have been shown to save as much as $235,000 in government funds. Not having a placement move in foster care saves money, and obviously higher levels of group care or reentry into foster care is more expensive than providing a level of support. So that when children are coming to foster care, the government is making an implicit statement that it can do a better job of taking care of the children. And we know that they need to do this. Ensuring that families who are raising vulnerable, traumatized children have the support they need should be part of that government commitment. And the more we help children toward meaningful, productive futures and away from institutional dependency, the better off all of us will be. So we believe that House File 1412 is a step toward ensuring the best possible outcomes for Minnesota's most vulnerable children. Kids who, for all their loss and trauma, still have the potential to shine.
All right. Thank you, Ms. Boo, for your testimony this morning. Ms. Martindale, welcome to the committee. If you could please state your name for the record and present your testimony.
My name is Julie Martindale, and I'd like to thank you, Mr. Chair, and committee members for allowing me to share my family's story. We told him that we would love him and stand by him no matter what. We welcomed him into our home for better or for worse. He was a six-year-old boy who had a charming smile and an engaging personality. He was also a six-year-old boy who had suffered great trauma throughout his life. That began when he was exposed to alcohol in utero. He then, beginning in infancy, entered and re-entered the foster care system so many times it was difficult to count. But children are so resilient, we were told. Oh, once he enters a home that's loving and stable, he will thrive. Once he has stability and structure, he will heal. And so we sought out every opportunity to learn about parenting a child with the past. We were thrilled to be living in Minnesota, a pro-adoption state that valued all children and took seriously their role in preparing adoptive families for the journey ahead of them. We took comfort in the success stories of adoptive families all around us, and so along with our other children, we excitedly welcomed into our home this little boy that deserved a family that was healthy, stable, and committed to him for life. We expected bumps in the road, but we did not know how much our son's past trauma and his fetal alcohol spectrum disorder would affect his life and our whole family. Our son began hoarding food, fighting at school, refusing to follow the rules that we had set for him. He was physically and verbally aggressive toward our other children and us. He lied and stole and ran away, and he eventually began fire setting. We had no idea how to address these issues that seemed so beyond our ability to handle. We were afraid that we would not be able to fulfill our promise to her, our promise to stand by him no matter what. We benefited greatly from the existing adoption services that were in place. Talking to other experienced adoptive parents helped us to learn the unique parenting techniques to heal and help heal a child with these issues. We learned to change the unattainable expectations that we had expected of him and learned to begin viewing his behaviors as the effects of trauma and brain damage he had suffered. We committed ourselves to making our home a place of healing. It made all the difference to have other adoptive parents provide emotional support and keep us going while the world around us blamed us for our son's challenges. But we needed so much more. We needed respite care, a school advocate that understood our challenge, and adoption-competent mental health services in our area that could help our whole family to bond with our son and help us to find hope again. I believe we would have benefited greatly from having an experienced navigator to help us find and access the social services that would help our son heal and help us to keep him safe. And we needed a crisis hotline on several occasions when we had no idea where to turn for the help we needed, when our son's behaviors were so out of control and we feared for his and our whole family's safety. We were desperate to speak to someone who could help guide our next steps when we felt powerless to handle our child. We believed then and still firmly believe today that adoption is the best way to give children who have lost their families along the way the best chance at life they can have. Our son is 20 years old now. He needs us as much today as he ever did. We have stood beside him during times of great trials, and we celebrated and continue to celebrate with him when he takes a step forward in his life, small steps towards independence and learning to make peace with his past. We celebrate adoption every day in our family. We have adopted 9 children out of the foster care system and fostered countless more. We wholeheartedly love adoption despite the challenges we have faced with our children. They are and always will be worth the struggles, the frustration, and the tears. Each of our children are succeeding. We have just learned to define success differently for each of them. Our story is just one of many. Every day I talk, email, or share on Facebook with other adoptive or foster parents who need the same kinds of supports that we needed as they parent their children are suffering from the effects of trauma. Families are dealing with devastating effects of sexual abuse their children have suffered. The families are faced with rages that go on for hours each evening after their child comes home from school. Each family has unique challenges, but all have a need for support services from other parents and professionals who understand the special circumstances of our lives. These families, like ours, who are willing to care for children in foster care, adoption, and kinship care, have a desperate need for more support. The great majority of children that we have cared for in our home have suffered from trauma and long-term effects of alcohol exposure in utero. Through no fault of their own, they need us. They need us as a society to help them. Trauma is often invisible, but not silent. It screams in ways that can't be ignored. It tears apart families if not addressed. We must support families who welcome children into their homes and their hearts through support, education, activities and groups for the kids and teens, trained, competent respite care services and mental health services, particularly in greater Minnesota. We live just in Elk River, not that far away, but it's still hard for us to get our kids to competent, trained professionals to help our kids find the therapy that they need. I've talked to too many families who are really close to giving up because they don't know what to do. Support services can keep families going and help children begin to heal. In Minnesota, we have more individuals and couples who are willing to foster, adopt, and care for relative children who have been in foster care. If we want them to step forward and do what's best for kids, they must know that the state of Minnesota is in partnership with them and that Minnesota will be there to support them no matter what.
All right. Thank you, Ms. Martindale, for your testimony this morning. Questions for the testifiers? Representative McDonald.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Question for perhaps the testifiers or someone else in the audience that would be an expert. I'm confident that there are services today that would help families that have their own child, birth child, that has troubles. Are those same services available for adopted children? Certainly you don't give up on your own child, birth child, and why would you give up on a...
Certainly, and that's part of what... thank you. part of what the navigators would help them find those services in their communities. So some of this is not adding new services. That's what we talk about, the navigation. That's about helping parents find what they need. But some of the things I want to be clear is that part of especially why we talk about peer support is there are things that are different for children who have experienced trauma, and there are things where adoption and foster care and kinship care have very unique circumstances. So there are, you know, there, if you know at the University of Minnesota, there's a permanency and adoption competency certificate to help mental health providers become competent in these particular issues. And there are other things where people need to know the special issues that come with this. So there are some services, sometimes where it's connecting to other services, and then there are some that really are very targeted to this population. Thank you.
Representative Freiberg.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think this question might be for the bill author. I just noticed it says that funding is available on line 1.13 to the extent federal funds are available. And then the appropriation section has a series of blank appropriations related to that federal funding. I'm just wondering, I mean, these all sound like really important and needed programs. I'm just wondering the extent to which there is funding for this in the state, what it's currently going towards, and if these programs are funded, if it would displace any existing programs.
And Representative Freiberg, the bill is moving to finance next as well. But Representative Pearson.
Well, thank you, Representative Peterson is in the room. Sorry. Thank you, Mr. Chair, and to your question. You know, we are working with the department right now, and again, we're looking to make sure that we're getting all of the federal funding that is available, and currently there are possibly some gaps that we're just trying to make sure that we're especially in the rural areas and whatnot, so make sure that these services are available throughout the state of Minnesota. And so it's really not displacing anything. But again, we'll be discussing that further with the department and as it moves forward into the Finance Committee.
Representative Freiberg. Representative Moran.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Something like the House research language. And part of the language says it will instruct the commissioner to design and implement a program to reduce the need for changes in child and youth foster, adopted, permanent physical and legal custody kinship placement. So either to the testifiers or to the author of this bill, can you give some clarity around what we mean by that language?
Representative Pearson.
I'll probably have experts speak on it also, but reducing the
I know what reducing means, but I'm sorry, I should let you finish.
No. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Your goal is to have a solid permanent placement, and so when you're talking about reducing having these kids removed from an existing home and go into another, go back to the foster system, I think is what the language is intended to do. But I guess I don't know if you want to speak to that also.
Ms. Boo.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair, Representative Moran. Again, the goal is to keep children in the placement if it's right for them. So if they're placed, if they exit foster care to a kinship care provider, that they get to stay with that kinship care provider, so that if the provider is struggling meeting the children's needs, the services are there so they don't have to leave. Same thing. So if they're in a foster placement and it's a good foster placement, they don't leave because parents are feeling overwhelmed. So that's the goal, is to really stabilize the kids in the proper placement.
Representative Moran.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So I ask that question because, who do not want kids when they're placed in out-of-home placement to be with a family who understands their trauma, right, who understands the stress that child is going through and the reason why he's acting out for many reasons, right? So who doesn't want that? And I'm trying to say this and say it in a good spirit that you're bringing this here, and that really allows foster parents, kinships, adoptive parents to have the support they need for that child. But I get a little concerned, one, because we have so many kids now who are going into the system And it's not always because of all the traumatic pieces that you stated. You know, we now know that kids are being pulled out of their homes because of poverty, right? Because we are a state now that's just erring on the side of precaution. And so when I hear language like this, you know, it leads me to believe also that because it can pull kids out of families into a permanent home in foster care, right, that doesn't allow the parents or the parent to reconnect to that child, who's going through the steps that they need to go through to be reunited with their child. So when I see language like this, I err on the side of what's going on here. Because we have a system that is really set up now that is pulling our kids into a system, right? And so we want to help support foster parents, but we also want to be able to create a system that is giving families the support that they need also, so that kids can be reunited to them, if at all possible. Because we want to err on the side of kids being safe, but if we're putting all the resources on this side, we're not able to make those connections to those families and to the communities where kids are being put out of the homes. And a lot of the trauma comes from that, to being separated from everything they know and everything that they care about, and they act out. And so the language concerns me. It is written, and I guess we can be really clear just attached to why they're in foster care, right? That foster care parents are getting the support they need, but we don't want to err on just that, because there's also families who are working really hard to be reunited with their children, their child or their children in their homes.
Representative Sandstedt.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Martindale, your story is my story. And this is one of the best bills I think I've ever heard of or seen personally as far as advocating for foster and adoptive families. I know that there are many supports in place for those families already, but the gaps are tremendous. The experiences that these families are facing and the resources out there, there's not enough resources. And when you talked about even rural Minnesota, that's our story. We had to take a break from foster care because it was a choice between either surviving, keeping our own family together, or losing everything that we had, our physical belongings, our emotional well-being, the well-being of our own children. So I would like to do whatever I can to get behind this and support you in that. I don't know what we can do. I don't think the funding has to be an either or. I think this needs to be a yes and. And I think we need to look long term at the cost. We either support and get the funding up front and try to help where we can, or we do look at long-term expenses like prison and other things. And we do have a shortage. We do have a shortage of foster and adoptive families now. And I just applaud you for this bill, Representative Pearson, and thank you for your testimony, and I think this is fantastic.
Thank you, Representative Sandstedt. Representative Tice.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I guess probably more of a comment right now. My niece and nephew are going through, they have a young girl and a little boy who are just precious, and they started out with just thinking about doing foster care, but I do know that there's a lot of work done with the parents to see if the kids can be put back with mom and dad, and so they've been basically just foster parents, and I think kind of that's the goal of why they go into foster care, is that there is work being done with the parents, the birth parents, to make sure that they can get the children back. I just heard in the last week or so that they are now going to an adoption proceeding because it looks like it's not going to work out. And that's sad. And before we heard testimony from the counties that they're concerned about the money that we want to put forth now. And I think we just save a ton of money if we do that now. And so we have to find a way to say, rather than putting the money in the back end when we hear stories like what we heard about Michael, about how then he goes into a different system as an adult. I think that if we take care of our children now, we get rid of a lot of those costs on the other side. And, yeah, it is difficult to make that switch, and maybe we don't do it the right way all the time. But I think our intention is, you know, if we do this now, you know, we just change the world. Because I remember, okay, I'm an Oprah geek. I watched every Oprah, and I loved the messages that were there. And I think it was Toni Morrison said that what your child wants more than anything is validation, that when they walk in a room, they want you to light up and know that you just love them unconditionally. And I think when we do foster care, we do that. We do that because I look at Nelson, and I've known him since he started this adoption process, and he can't talk enough about his son. He can't talk enough about all his kids. But it's a treat to see his face light up and know that that's his passion. My husband and I kind of collect kids too, which sounds kind of weird, but, I've got there's a lot of guys out there now that call me mom. There's an officer in Boston that calls me mom on Facebook. He always calls me mom. You know, there's a lot of folks that do this without having to. We see the need in kids. And I just think we just do our counties, our state, a better job if we really look at what we can do up front rather than on the backside. So I love these bills. They're dear to my heart, and I just want to thank you for bringing this forward.
Representative Moran.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Comment. I like this bill too, right? I think, again, that foster parents should have the support they need to raise kids and still be able to do it effectively. Right? But I've also worked with parents who've lost their kids to the system or who are in foster care, to who are trying to navigate a system that is not navigatable. Right? Who don't have the support, who's trying to do that by themselves, because we have representation for the kids and not the parents. And I watched parents lose custody because maybe they are addictive. And that takes time. And our current law doesn't give them that time. Right? And so I agree that we should do this. But I'm also advocating that we need to do the other piece too. And that we do need to look at the front end of this piece. Because if we don't invest in the front end, that we will see all the issues that we see on the back end. And so, I cannot say anything bad about this bill, but I just do want to bring that awareness that this is on both ends and about how we can do our due diligence as lawmakers to be just as informed as we can, because we want kids to be in strong, thriving environments, right? And we do often know that if at all possible for them to be with their family, that's the first thing that we should do, because often enough they go back to their families. They do. You know, not always, but often enough. Especially they age out by 18, they're looking for the families. So I just wanted to share that and to be clear that, you know, this is not something I'm against, but as we begin to move bills through this body and we advocate for foster parents because we have created a system now that is bringing our kids into that system, that we also realize that there are a lot of loving parents out there who have not been abusive but who just are poor or kids are then absent from school. And so there's many reasons why kids are pulled out of homes and put into foster care, and it's happening even more now because of where we are as a state.
Is there anyone else who wishes to testify for or against this bill? Seeing none, final word, Representative Pearson.
Mr. Chair, first of all, Representative Moran, to your point, I'm happy to help you and work with those specific areas where our system isn't working. I've heard that amongst constituents, and I know that message is clear also. We want families to stay together. We want loving, caring families to stay together. We want children taken care of. And This is not trying to work against that, but I hear your message, and if there are ways that I can help you improve the system on the other side, I'm all for that and happy to work with you on that. Again, we continue to work with the department to figure out some of the programs that are available and how to fill these gaps for the families that we're talking about this morning, and I appreciate your consideration, Mr. Chair.
With that, I'll renew my motion that House File 1412 be referred to the Committee on Health and Human Services Finance. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, same sign. Motion is adopted, and House File 1412 is being referred to the Committee on Health and Human Services Finance. Thank you both for your testimony this morning. Next up, we will bring up House File 733, Representative Haley. I will move that House File 733 be referred to the General Register. Representative Haley, as briefly as you can, please.
Thank you, Chair Schumacher. First, briefly, I will offer some treats, as this is my first appearance in front of this committee, so my offering is Girl Scout cookies.
I think we're ready to vote, then, Representative. To your bill.
Thank you, Chair and members. I'd like to introduce House File 733. This is a cleanup bill that makes some corrections to the 2014 Nurse Practice Act. And it's focused on the licensing around advanced practice nurses. So some first important things. This does not change scope of practice. There's no fiscal impact to this bill. The changes it accomplishes are mainly technical or operational. The companion bill, Senate File 527, has passed out of committee and was already passed off the Senate floor. There is no known opposition. In your packets, you have some letters from the Registered Nurses Association and Medical Boards of Practice. Again, this bill focuses on Minnesota's APRNs, which are clinical nurse specialists, nurse midwives, nurse anesthetists, and nurse practitioners. I'll highlight three of the important changes. The first one, as a definition of the term encumbered, because there's some confusion in the original legislation as to whether a nurse is eligible for an APRN license if they're being monitored or participating in a services program. Basically, this change treats nurses the same way that other health professionals, such as doctors and dentists, are treated. Second change, it requires 5 additional graduate-level courses and health assessments to be completed in order to get an APRN license. Most programs may have these additional courses, but not all in the country do. So this language assures that all individuals licensed in Minnesota will have the same standards. The last change allows for verification that the 2,080 hours of postgraduate practice by a nurse practitioner in any other U.S. jurisdiction other than Minnesota would qualify. This is similar to licensing issues that we have with teachers. We want nurses that have completed that practice in other states to be able to come and work in Minnesota without having to repeat those 2,080 hours of postgraduate work. And lastly, there's some language that clarifies the license process, that any nurse applying for an APRN license in Minnesota would meet the requirements of the Minnesota law. The reason I'm supporting this bill on the larger perspective is that we all know that we need increased access to care, and nurse practitioners play a vital role in that process. And we also are facing workforce shortages in nursing, and cleaning up this licensing process should help fill that gap as well. I will open for any questions, and specifically technical questions, Ms. Brecken, the Executive Director of the Minnesota Board of Nursing, would be able to answer. Thank you.
Are there any questions for Representative Wheeling?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And this would be more for Ms. Brecken. So when this bill passed, when the authorization passed for APRNs to practice independently, the one of the big justifications for that or arguments for the need for that was that we had shortages of primary care in particular, and that if nurse practitioners did not have to practice in connection with a physician, that they would go out and provide care in underserved areas. And I wonder if you have any update for us on that. Has that happened? Is it starting to happen? I know this hasn't been in effect
all that long. I don't know if it's been, what? Well, maybe you can tell us. I don't remember what, 4 years maybe?
Ms. Bracken, welcome to the committee. If you could please state your name for the record and help Representative Liebling with her question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative Liebling. My name is Shirley Bracken. I'm the Executive Director for the Minnesota Board of Nursing. Representative Liebling, you're right. I think that, you know, you are correct in the history in terms of the advocacy for the changes that were made to the Practice Act in 2014. That's when the Advanced Practice Registered Nurse Licensure Bill, you know, the amendments to the Practice Act resulted in licensure for APRNs. At the time that the bill passed, there were approximately 6,500 advanced practice registered nurses in Minnesota. Today it is nearly 8,000. So that number has definitely increased. We have tracked where those individuals are practicing or, you know, or where they're located in the state. It continues to be that primarily they're located in the metropolitan area, the Rochester area, Duluth, you know, the larger population areas in the state. We are seeing more located in the greater Minnesota. I don't have those numbers with me today, but we have mapped it out, and I'd be happy to provide those to you.
Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Ms. Bracken. I would really be interested in seeing that. The other piece, I just wanted a little more explanation of the addition of some courses, because I, you know, this is sort of, today we're hearing that this is cleanup. But this bill got a ton of scrutiny when it went through initially, and it sort of gives me pause to think that we missed some, you know, where we were allowing some people to practice who didn't have some things that would seem to be pretty important, since what we did was allow them to practice without any oversight by anybody as complete independent practitioners. So can you give me some comfort that we haven't put into practice some people who didn't have advanced health assessment skills and these other things that are now being added?
Ms. Bergen.
Mr. Chair, Representative Liebling, those courses that are listed in the Practice Act all along have been a part of the American Association of Colleges of Nursing in their accreditation process through the CCNE for advanced practice registered nurse programs. There were, prior to, historically, not all the programs have been graduate level programs. They are now, and that is the standard. And so there were individuals who were grandfathered in who had been practicing for, you know, many years as advanced practice registered nurses. Those courses have been codified, per se, or wish to be codified. We want them to be codified in law because there are some programs in the country that don't have all of those courses in their programs. There are very few. That's the direction all of the advanced practice registered nurse programs are moving toward, but we wanted to be assured that, you know, from that date forward, that the individuals who became licensed in Minnesota met the same requirements as all the programs of Minnesota that do have advanced practice registered nurse programs, that they have those included, and we wanted the same for anyone who came into Minnesota.
Okay,
Representative Liebling.
Thank you. Thank you for that, Ms. Bracken, because one of my concerns at the time, I think, was that the standards were being, as I recall, kind of given to a national certifying organization. Okay. And that always kind of gives me pause because, you know, sometimes in Minnesota we have higher standards for things than other states might. And so it sounds to me like what you're doing is, again, making sure that our standards are high as opposed to somebody who might just have some certification from elsewhere. So I appreciate that. Thank you.
Representative Albright.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Bracken, or for the author of the amendment, or the Bill, I'm looking at the repealer under 148.211 subsection B, where it says an advanced practice registered nurse licensed under the subdivisions shall maintain all practice privileges provided to licensed
Representative Albright, if you could speak into the microphone, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm just concerned that I don't see anywhere in the body of the bill where that requirement for licensure is moved to. And I'll apologize in advance that I probably have not found it, but I'm just wanting to make sure that we're not repealing something without replacing it in another section of code.
Ms. Brecken.
Mr. Chair, Representative Albright, I'm sorry, I have to ask you to repeat what you were referring to. I didn't quite hear it.
See you the microphone, Representative Albright.
It's my age.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Under the repealer, 148.211 licensing is repealed, and the last two lines in that section of code discusses the requirement for a license to be held, and that all practice privileges provided to licensed advanced practice registered nurses under this chapter. So I'm just wondering where that obligation is fulfilled in another section of code, or am I missing it in the body of the bill, House File 733?
Ms. Brecken.
Mr. Chair, Representative Albright, that particular provision was a grandfathering provision, 148.211 sub 1B. That is no longer needed because we have licensed individuals in Minnesota, and so that grandfathering no longer applies.
Representative Albright.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, for the opportunity to speak before this committee.
Any further questions for the bill author? Seeing none, is there anyone in the audience who wishes to testify for or against House File 733? Seeing none, final word, Representative Haley.
Thank you for allowing us to testify this morning, and we move approval of the bill.
All right. With that, Representative Haley, I will renew my motion that House File 733 be re-referred to the General Register. All those in favor, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Aye. Same sign. The motion is adopted, and House File 733 is re-referred to the committee, or re-referred to the General Register. Excuse me.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee.
And members, we only have a few minutes left, but we will get through at least the introduction portion of Representative Peterson's bill, House File 643. As she's making her way over, we will move that House File 643 be re-referred to the Committee on Public Safety. Representative Peterson, you have an A1 amendment?
Yes, Mr. Chair. And I'd like to move that A1 amendment.
Representative Peterson moves the A1 amendment to the amendment.
The A1 amendment was basically to address some stakeholder claim concerns, and so they'll get the bill in the form I'd like it to be.
All right, any questions on the A1 amendment? Seeing none, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign. The A1 amendment is adopted. Representative Peterson, to your bill the way you want it.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. This is the Minnesota Board of Medical Practice Housekeeping Bill, and their mandate and mission is to protect the public's health and safety by assuring that the people who practice medicine are competent, ethical practitioners with the necessary knowledge and skills appropriate for their title and role. And basically, there are two items in this bill. First is clarifying the title protection, and secondly, laying out the grounds for discipline for improper, unethical behavior by providing some more clarity and accuracy. And I do have Ruth Martinez, who is the executive director with this Minnesota Board of Medical Practice, for available to answer questions.
All right. Are there any questions for the bill author? Representative Quam.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Representative Peterson. On 6.6 through 6.10, is there any concern that this would change of verbiage have on off-labeling MS, other conditions, syndromes, diseases, have complications which are not uncommon to have off-label prescription? And I just want to make sure there's no issue with this.
Ms. Martinez, welcome to the committee. If you could please state your name for the record and answer Representative Quam's questions.
Mr. Chair, Representative Quam, thank you very much. My name is Ruth Martinez. I'm the Executive Director of the Minnesota Board of Medical Practice. Thanks for your question. This is language, actually, that has been modified very little in this section. And to your question, this does not change how the board would enforce prescribing for experimental purposes. We're really, from a regulatory perspective, we're really looking for intent behind some of that experimental drugs. We certainly appreciate there are off-label uses for drugs, and that's not new, and that's I don't anticipate any change in how we would prosecute those cases.
Representative Quam. All right, any other questions for House File 643? Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Ms. Martinez, I right now as I'm noticing that on 6.8 to 6.10 that you've taken out basically an inappropriate referral. Is that being dealt with elsewhere? Because I can only imagine that that might, you know, that an inappropriate referral could really be problematic. I mean, I know in other states, mainly we hear about, you know, financial arrangements where there's, you know, referrals are made for other than medical reasons. And notably, I have not heard about that happening here, but I'm just wondering if you're covering that elsewhere in the Act.
Ms. Martinez.
Mr. Chair, Representative Liebling, thanks very much. Yes, that is covered elsewhere, and I don't have the exact line for you, but we felt it was located in a strange place, and so we put it in a more appropriate section of the statute. Thank you.
Representative Liebling.
That's it, Mr. Chair.
Okay, any other questions for the bill author? Is there anyone else who wishes to testify on House File 643? Seeing none, final word, Representative Peterson.
Oh, yes.
All right, with that, Representative Peterson renews her motion that House File 643, as amended, be referred to the Committee on Public Safety. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, same sign. The motion prevails on House File 643, as amended, is referred to the Committee on Public Safety. Now, members, I do not believe we are able to get through these last two bills in 5 minutes, so we will stand in recess for now, and I will have an announcement sent out by email and during the floor session today as to the room and time that we will come back to finish these two bills. We stand in recess. Mm-hmm. All right, the Health and Human Service Reform Committee will come back to order. We did get quorum this morning, so we do not have to reinstate that. So we are able to move along with bills. The first bill up this evening is House File 526, Representative Zerwas. Representative Zerwas could not make it tonight, so co-author Representative Albright was gracious enough to give his time and abilities to this bill so that we were able to move it forward yet today. So Representative Albright will move that House File 526 is referred to the Committee on Government Operations. We have the bill in front of us. Representative Albright, to your bill.
Can you hear me now?
Yes, sir. Well done.
Mr. Chair and members, House File 526 is a bill calling for moving occupational therapy practitioner licensing out of the Minnesota Department of Health. I'm happy to be a co-author on this bill with Representative Zerwas, and I will be brief in my remarks and then turn over the remainder of my time to the testifier. The background on this is that the occupational therapy in Minnesota has been regulated by the Minnesota Department of Health since 1996. Decisions about the scope of practice, ethical practice, and continued competency for occupational therapy are made by MDH staff who are not occupational therapy practitioners. MDH staff meet with an advisory committee about 3 times a year. A 7-member committee has 2 occupational therapists, 2 occupational therapy assistants, a medical professional, and 2 public members. There are nearly 5,000 licensed occupational therapists and occupational therapy practitioners in Minnesota. So why is this change needed? Until 2016, the MDH has collected fees that exceed the cost of administering the program. At one time, the excess was so large that MDH came to the legislature and passed a bill that included a 2-year moratorium on collecting fees. The MDH has enough excess funds in the Occupational Therapy Licensure Fund to run the program without collecting any fees. Over $750,000 of fees collected by the MDH have been used for other purposes than regulating the profession since 2006. Excess fees charged by the MDH have been used to pay for rental space for other divisions of MDH. There have been significant delays in getting temporary and initial licenses to new occupational therapy practitioners, frustrating employers and practitioners. The MDH is charged with investigating allegations of incompetent, illegal, and unethical practice. Points being several occupational therapy practitioners have had their cases dismissed because the MDH violated their due process rights for taking years and years to investigate the allegations. One case of sexual misconduct was under investigation for over 8 years with no resolution. Because occupational therapy does not have its own board, it is excluded from legislation intended to apply to all licensed health professionals listed in Minnesota Statute 214. A bill that called for shortening the statute of limitations for healthcare malpractice claims from 6 years to 2 years included these professions who have boards listed in Minnesota Statute 214. This bill does not list the MDH, so the Minnesota Occupational Therapy Association had to pursue legislation to make the statute of limitations the same for occupational therapy as other professions. Because occupational therapy was not named by name as a health licensing board in legislation calling for enhanced background checks for occupational therapy practitioners, the FBI has refused to cooperate with the MDH. And with that, Mr. Chair, I would just refer to the testifier, Ms. Peggy Brandenburg.
All right. Welcome to the committee. If you could please state your name for the record and present your testimony.
Sure. My name is Peggy Brandenburg, and I am the Vice President of Advocacy for the Minnesota Occupational Therapy Association. Thank you, Representative Albrecht. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'll make my testimony short, as I know you are.
Very much appreciated, Ms. Brandenburg. Right.
So thank you for the opportunity to testify on the behalf of the Minnesota Occupational Therapy Association. We are asking you to support House File 526, a bill calling for the creation of a Minnesota Board of Occupational Therapy to assume increased accountability for our regulation of the profession of occupational therapy and to be recognized as a healthcare profession similar to our colleagues. Some of you may have met with occupational therapy constituents yesterday as we had approximately 150 participants represented at OT Day at the Capitol to support and talk with you about this bill. This bill is not requesting to change any part of the occupational therapy scope of practice or what is being regulated. Rather, we are requesting a change in who regulates the occupational therapy profession. Occupational therapy practitioners have been regulated by the Minnesota Department of Health since 1996. The Department of Health staff are making the decisions around scope of practice, and we really feel like this needs to be regulated by occupational therapists. Over the years, there have been many challenges experienced by occupational therapy practitioners related to timeliness of obtaining temporary and permanent licenses. This has been very frustrating, and it impacts patients' access to health care because of the delay in licensing. The investigations and allegations of incompetence, illegal and unethical practice are also a concern for us, and really we feel like we need to, they've been dismissed at the Minnesota Department of Health because of due process violations. The fees collected by the Minnesota Department of Health also have exceeded the cost to administer the program. The Minnesota Board of Occupational Therapy, if we're able to create that, will be totally funded by licensing fees from occupational therapists. We believe that with the growth in the number of practitioners in the profession to almost 5,000, that now is the right time to move forward to create a Board of Occupational Therapy to have our own profession regulate our profession. We believe that we can improve timeliness of processing license and investigations and to be recognized as a health profession similar to our colleagues. Thank you.
All right. Thank you, Ms. Brandenburg, for your testimony this evening. Are there any questions for Ms. Brandenburg on House File 526? Seeing none, the committee thanks you for your testimony. Is there anyone in the audience that wishes to testify on House File 526? Seeing none, are there any final questions for the bill author? Seeing none, final word for the bill author, Representative Albright.
Thank you.
With that, Representative Albright renews his motion that House File 526 be referred to the Committee on Government Operations. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, same sign. The motion prepared for House File 526 is referred to the Committee on Government Operations. Thank you very much. Okay. Finally, tonight, members, we have House File 1110. And as Representative West makes his way up to the testifying table, I will move that House File 1110 be referred to the General Register. Welcome to the committee, Representative West. The bill is in front of us. Please present when you're ready.
Next, I've already been seated.
Oh.
That, yeah, have Adam. And somebody's got them over there. There should be two packages of delicious fudge stripe cookies, as is my due here.
Welcome to your first hearing, Representative West.
Thank you. It is a delight to be here. HF 1110 is a simple dental licensure bill that adds dental assistants and therapists the ability to have their examinations waived by the Board of Dentistry. And it changes from or graduate or certified to they must graduate from an accredited institution and be certified by the Board of Dentistry. And it permits them to do some specific procedures as listed in the bill. And I have Bridget Anderson here if there are any more specific questions to that. But
all right.
That's all I got.
Thank you, Representative West. Are there any questions on the bill? House File 1110 for the author or for Ms. Anderson. Seeing none, is there anyone in the audience that wishes to testify on House File 1110? Anybody? Anybody? Okay. We'll close public testimony. Any final questions for Representative West on House File 1110? Well, Representative West, you're getting by very lucky on your first bill. Final word, Representative West.
I'll plagiarize. Thank you.
All right. I will renew my motion then that House File 1110 be referred to the General Register. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All right. Same sign. The motion prevails and House File 1110 is referred to the General Register. Thank you, Representative West. With that, we are adjourned.